Science fiction is the major source of ideas about how the world we live in could be a made-up world, a computer simulation. But open the field up and take in things like religion, and you realize a lot of fields of knowledge and belief have considered that there are other universes, and that maybe the one we spend our time in is not the main one. Rizwan Virk takes in the broad view of all these fields in a mind-expanding book called The Simulation Hypothesis. An MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics agree we are in a video game. Are we in a video game? Don't decide yet. First, we get to visit with Rizwan Virk, who is a hard guy to categorize because he's into a lot. He's got degrees in computer science from MIT and management from Stanford, and he's been a video game producer, film producer, investor, and entrepreneur. Rizwan Virk, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me on.
So you write of thinking about the worlds within video games that you played as a kid. Tell us about that.
So, you know, when I was a kid, I used to play what we would consider fairly simple video games, like on the Atari system back in the day, you know, classic games like Space Invaders and Pac-Man. And, you know, there was a racing game called Pole Position. And, you know, even as a kid, I'd watch the car go around the tracks, and I'd notice they'd have these simulated people on the bleachers, and then off in the distance there might be some mountains and some clouds. And I always wondered, you know, what was going on in that virtual world beyond what I could see, you know, from where my car was on the track. And of course, back then I didn't know enough about how games were developed to really take this question, you know, more seriously. But then, you know, over time, as I got involved in building video games and studying computer science at MIT, a few years ago I was playing a virtual reality game. It was a virtual reality ping pong game. And I was playing it, and it was so realistic that I forgot that I had goggles on and that I wasn't actually playing ping pong, so much so that at the end of the game, I decided to put the paddle down on the table and to lean against the table, you know, just like I might do if I was actually playing. And, of course, there was no table, and there was no paddle. It was a control. The controller fell to the ground, and I almost fell over. And that's when I realized that, you know, our technology was getting better and better to the point where we could fool ourselves pretty soon to thinking we were inside, reality when we're actually inside a video game. And so that really led me to thinking about, you know, what would the stages of technology be to build something like that which was depicted in The Matrix. And that's really what led me to write the book.
And we should point out that you were talking about the racing game where you could, you know, see, you wondered about the people in the crowds and the clouds off in the distance, that sort of thing. But this is not necessarily a game where you know, people get stuff and move stuff around. But one of the games you designed is Tapfish, which is a resource management game. What is a resource management game?
Sure. So, you know, resource management games, also sometimes called simulation games, are games where you have to make decisions about, you know, where to apply resources. To a certain extent, you know, many free-to-play games today have an element of resource management. You have a certain number of virtual goods. You can use those to, in Tapfish, for example, you could use those to buy little baby fish eggs, which you would then have to raise. And then, you know, you allocate across different objects that you might want to buy to put in your fish tank. And you can see, you know, this idea in certain games like The Sims, right, which EA came out with The Sims 4 not that long ago, and I believe that's one of the best-selling games of all time. And in those environments, you know, you have actual people, avatars that you're playing, and those avatars live virtual lives, right, with virtual apartments and with virtual furniture and sometimes with virtual relationships. And so, you know, what's happening, the games that I designed were more relatively fun, casual games, but as you get more and more immersive games, even Minecraft, you know, there's a certain amount of resources you have, you use for raw materials, and you use those to build things, and then you share those with other people. And so, you know, this idea that we're now dealing with virtual resources and not physical resources is kind of an interesting shift. And, you know, it's one, I mentioned The Sims, there was a game called Second Life back in the 2000s that got pretty popular for a while, and people had actually had jobs and they were earning virtual currency within the virtual world. And so, you know, we're starting to see virtual worlds becoming more and more sophisticated, more and more interactive with more resources that you have to manage, And so people start to live virtual lives, you know, within these worlds. That's really kind of an underlying theme of the book.
Weren't there some sim games, some resource management games, where the creators decided that the resources were finite, and yet they had to change their minds later on because they were all depleted by the players?
Well, there's, you know, in Second Life, for example, you know, there were a certain number of sims or servers, which was virtual land. And so what happened for a while was that the land started to get valuable, and there were actually, we call them, you know, Second Life millionaires at the time, because they owned virtual land and there was only so much. But then all that land got used up, so eventually they added more virtual land, and then, of course, the price of the virtual land plummeted. But my guess is that's, you know, probably happened many times. When you think about, you know, what gives resource value, it tends to be some element of scarcity. And it's sort of a trick we used in the video game world, where we would have limited edition of certain virtual items. And, of course, there's no real limit, right? If it's just virtual, the server can just say, okay, let's make another 1,000 or another 1,000,000 of those, right? It's just a number on the server. But if you limit it, then it appears to the players that there is, in fact, a scarcity of resources, and that makes certain items more desirable than others, which then actually gives them value in the real world. And so you have people trading virtual goods for real money because, you know, they want to get that specific item.
Wow. So obviously we're doing a lot of the things that we do in an economy within the simulations themselves, which would seem to strengthen the case for what you're talking about here. The book is called The Simulation Hypothesis. An MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics agree we are in a video game. We'll explore the agreement and the various theories that lead to this when we come back and talk more with Rizwan Virk, the author of the book on the Jefferson Exchange. You're welcome to join us by phone and email. We're back in a minute 25. Rizwan, we focused on video games in the first part of the conversation, but you point out quickly this is not just a video game era musing that Plato and others thought in terms of other worlds.
So this is an idea that really has existed in various forms, you know, for thousands of years. You know, going back to the allegory of Plato's cave, where, you know, he suggested that what if we were all inside a cave and we're chained to one wall, and the only thing we can see is this other wall that is opposite the mouth of the cave. And so what we see on that wall are really shadows of whatever is happening outside the cave, right? And even then, it's only a very limited view because it's only what's happening right in front of the mouth of the cave. So, you know, he said that it's possible we were all inside a world like this, and the real world is out there, but if someone were to break free and go out there and see what was out there and then come back and tell us everything that we've seen is an illusion, it's you know, shadows on the wall, people would say that person was crazy, right? Because we're all used to a certain reality. So, you know, that's one of the oldest incarnations of that argument. Of course, you know, more recently, it's still pretty long ago, but if you look at Descartes, you know, 500 years ago or whenever it was, you know, he suggested that what if there was an evil demon that was tricking him into thinking everything in the world was real, when in fact, you know, it wasn't real. But, you know, he came up with the famous phrase, well, the only thing that I know is that I think, therefore I am, right? And he also, you know, had a similar version of that argument that had to do with dreams. And so, you know, turns out within the world of philosophy, you know, this is a concept that's been considered in various forms. Right, that there is another world outside of this one, and what if everything I'm seeing could be subjective? You know, there was a famous guy, Bishop Berkeley, after whom Berkeley, California, is named, who talked about idealism, which is the idea that everything is just happening in my mind. And so, you know, there's various versions of these. I like to think of these as the kind of single-player or multiplayer versions of video games. And turns out, you know, within the religious traditions as well, they've been telling us that the physical world we see around us is not the real world. And in the Eastern traditions where you have reincarnation and karma, you almost don't have to make an analogy. They basically tell us that the world is maya or illusion, and that there's a soul that exists outside this world. It downloads into a body, which is very much like an avatar, you know, that we have when we're playing video games. We live the life and play that role, and there are forces keeping track of what happens to us during that gameplay session. Where does that information live? Well, you know, as a computer scientist, I would say it lives in a cloud server somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in the rendered world. We then, at the end of our lives, upload our consciousness back out of the physical world, but that information about that life is still stored somewhere. And then they call it karma, and then we come back and we play, another role. And so in the book, I talk about this idea of karma as quests and achievements. I mean, most video games today are not like the single-player games where you just, you know, go around the track again and again from 30 years ago, but there are various achievements and quests that your character, you know, has to go through in order to level up. And so it turns out, to keep track of something like karma, you don't need metaphorical lords of karma. You just need a good questing system that keeps track of everything that happens, and then you can have interactions with those same players in the future. So that's yet another version of this idea that the world we live in is not quite the real world.
So really broad stretch from science fiction to science to religion as well. We'll get into these in further detail as well. Rizwan Virk is our guest. His book is The Simulation Hypothesis. An MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics agree we are in a video game. Let's take a call now from Ryan in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, I just wanted to bring in another lens on this. I was doing a professional development workshop, and I was showing these beautiful pictures of the Arctic ice, and they showed Arctic ice in 2020, 2040, and 2060. And I asked the audience, where did we get this data for 2040 and 2060? How did we get these images? And they said, well, we went there. And I went, wait a second, that doesn't, you know, anyway. So one of the things about computer modeling is that we're living in a virtual world. In, you know, our climate models, in our economic models, we're always extending ourselves out into that sort of computational thinking world. And I think that we're blurring that line more than we realize, which is another version of that, you know, this conversation of what, you know, what constitutes reality and how well is our brain adapted to sort of telling the difference.
All right.
Anyway,
interesting. Thanks for the point, Ryan. Appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
I mean, I would say that, you know, if you think of computer simulations, you know, they're used today pretty much in every field. And sometimes people ask me, well, why would somebody run a simulation of the world? And I say, well, why do we run simulations, right? We run them, in this case, it was for climate-related simulations, right? And a simulation could be as simple as, you know, you have fruit flies, and then every year you're seeing the population change with a certain death rate and a certain number of new fruit flies. And so the clock speed is 1 year at a time. So you can use simulations to model the weather, to model populations, plagues and epidemics, right? You see that a lot these days where there are all these different simulations that people have put out there. And so that's one reason why we run simulations, is to see what might happen. You know, there's this idea in a field called chaos theory of, you know, the butterfly flaps its wings in China and it affects the stock market in London. And the idea is that there are so many steps along the way, there's no way to know exactly what will happen unless you actually run a simulation through the number of steps. So there's a principle called computational irreducibility. And so I think, you know, as our simulations become more and more sophisticated, and, you know, there was a game a few years ago called No Man's Sky. And in that game, there were 18 quintillion planets. Now, of course, the people who made that game did not sit down and, you know, write out everything that's happening on that many planets. There's just no way to do that. They used procedural generation using fractal algorithms so that whenever you're on a planet, it looks kind of unique because of these algorithms will run and create the flora and the fauna and the wildlife and make it look like a unique world. And why 18 quintillion? Well, it turns out that's the maximum number you can have with 64 bits.
Oh.
And so, you know, our simulations are getting more and more sophisticated, which leads to this idea that someone may already have created a simulation that's indistinguishable from reality.
Okay, so before we explore any further, then let's get to the concept of how we might figure out if this is true or not. How does one get out of this? Obviously, they figured out of the Matrix, but even earlier than that, in that that Star Trek episode, what was it called? Ship in a Bottle, from 1993, Star Trek: The Next Generation, where they created a holodeck character of Moriarty from the Sherlock Holmes stories, who figured out.
Right. Yeah, and that was, for me, that was one of the moments when I really started to think about this idea was, they had a holodeck which was able to create very realistic characters with AIs in there, and one of them was Professor Moriarty, who's Sherlock Holmes' nemesis. And, they decided to make him really intelligent, and he figured out that some of the people in the simulation were actually from out there, outside that world. And out there in his world meant the Enterprise, the rest of the Enterprise, right? So that was our world. And some were just, within the holographic reality. And so this is a question that comes up. If you remember in The Matrix, when Neo woke up, right, he had that wire connected, right, into the back of his head. And they were beaming signals directly down there. Now, there are some people who think, well, there's no way to figure it out, therefore it doesn't really matter, or that we can't really prove that it's not true, therefore we shouldn't pay attention to it. But, just because we can't prove something is not true doesn't mean we can't find evidence that might lead us, in that direction. And we can look at this from a science perspective, or we can look at this from a religious perspective, because I believe they're both ways to search for the truth. From the science perspective, there's a lot of anomalies in quantum physics that lead me to believe that what's actually happening is optimization. So, one of the biggest mysteries in quantum physics is this idea of the observer effect, or what they call quantum indeterminacy. And it's this idea that a particle can be in multiple states until somebody observes it. Probably a simpler way to explain it is using the example of Schrodinger's cat, who's a theoretical cat in a box with some radioactive material, and after an hour there's a 50% chance the cat is dead and 50% chance the cat is alive. Now, common sense tells us, okay, the cat is either dead or alive. There's only one reality, but we don't know because we haven't looked in the box. And when we look in the box, we'll see what reality it was. But quantum physics, again and again, is telling us something different, something that's kind of unexplainable. And that is that the cat is both alive and dead, so both possibilities exist until there is an observer, so until somebody looks at it. Now, I thought about this, and I thought, well, it turns out that golden rule, which is you render only that which is observed, and until it's observed, it's just probabilities or information, is actually very similar to how we build video games. So if you were to, ask somebody back in the 1980s, can you build something like Fortnite or PUBG, or World of Warcraft, which is a fully 3D MMORPGs, right, massively multiplayer online role-playing games, the answer would be no, because we don't have enough computing power to render all those pixels. However, what happened in the meantime is we figured out optimization techniques. There was a game called Doom in the 1990s, which you may remember, some of the listeners may remember.
Mm-hmm, sure.
It was one of the first popular, first-person points of view, and they were able to basically render only what your character is seeing. And as you moved left or right, they were able to render it quickly enough that it felt like, you were in a fully 3D world. Well, it turns out that's pretty much the techniques we use with 3D modeling. If you and I are both playing, let's say, Fortnite, I only see, what my character might see, and you see what your character might see. There actually is no shared rendering, right? Rendering happens based on the state of the observer. And so every single laptop or every single phone in an MMORPG today is rendering a piece of the full world.
So there's not a universe. There's not a universe with individual cameras in it. For example, it's just that you only get to see the projection of what you're looking at from your angle.
Right. I mean, you could say that we all have our own virtual cameras, right? That's a way of thinking about it. But the reality is, it's just information. And then we're just looking at little pieces of that information. And so the physical universe may not be what we think it is, right? The more and more that physics tries to figure out what is matter, you know, they keep opening it up and saying, okay, there's a molecule and then there's an atom, but that's 99.9% empty space. And then there's you know, the protons and neutrons. Oh, but that's really quarks. But they keep going down, right? And they can't find this thing called physical matter. In the end, the best explanation physicists have come up with is that it's, we can talk about the properties of matter, but we can't talk about matter itself. And so, you know, there's a physicist named John Wheeler who was pretty well known. I think he was at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study. And he studied with Einstein, and he came up with this phrase, it from bit. You know, he said everything that we think of as an it, a physical object, is actually based on information or bits. And at lowest level, it's just, you know, an on or off state. And he said that physics went through three phases in his lifetime. Initially, everything was a particle, so we thought everything was solid, and it followed Newtonian mechanics. And then they thought everything was a field of probabilities, and that's what happened with quantum physics. And then at the end, he said, well, everything is just information. And that was kind of the conclusion he came to. And so, you know, matter may not be what we think it is. The physical world may not even be what we think it is. A lot of why these things, we can't explain these things in quantum physics, is we don't know the why are they happening. Well, it turns out if it's an optimization technique, then it makes actually much more sense.
Rizwan Virk, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Simulation Hypothesis, an MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics agree we are in a video game. So are we talking about essentially the opposite of object permanence? You know, the idea that, that even though the ball rolls behind the chair, there's still a ball there. I mean, you don't have that in video games, I think is what you're saying, and quantum physics suggests that might be the same thing in the real universe?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, as I said, these mysteries in quantum physics, no one's able to figure it out. So the ball was there, and then it goes behind a chair or in another room. It no longer needs to be rendered on your computer, right? Now, there's still information about that ball somewhere, but it doesn't mean that it's physically there. And so, you know, when you have multiple observers, it's possible that we have a consensus or shared world. That's what we call caching in the computer science world, where, you know, if somebody visited or saw that thing recently, then the pixels are there. But if you think back again to how video games developed, like there was a game back in the 80s called King's Quest, and it was one of the first RPGs on PCs. And in that game, all the world was actually laid out with all the pixels were drawn, and they were sitting there on disk. So all I had to do was render my character on the scene, and then he moves to the right, he walks to the right. All I had to do was take the pixels from disk and just put them on the screen and then scroll them, right? So the old view of the physical world is like that, that all the pixels are there, we move around, but everything is there. But the new view is that, well, it's not so quite so clear. We basically render that which is observed or recorded. Now, there's some debate on whether you need a conscious observer or not, and this brings us to kind of a bigger debate in the simulation hypothesis, which is everyone an AI, or are we actually playing avatars and roles like in the Matrix?
So is there a concept of the Turing test for AI? I mean, some argument about whether it's been passed yet.
Yeah, I think, you know, most people would say it hasn't been passed yet in general. So the Turing test, most people have probably heard of it, but in case they didn't, there was a gentleman named Alan Turing, who was a mathematician and computer scientist, and, you know, he proposed this test, which he called the imitation game, where if you had a computer behind curtain A and you had a person behind curtain B, and all you could do was exchange messages. Now, you know, today that might be voice messages or text messages. Back then he called it teletypes, right, what they could understand. And he said if you send messages and get responses and you can't tell whether it's a computer or it's a person, then, you know, they have passed the imitation game. Now, we would say it's not really a physical computer. It doesn't have to be a robot. It's just an AI, right? So it's actually software that would need to pass the Turing test. And so there's different aspects to it. One aspect is, can it produce a voice and talk in such a way that you think it's real? And, you know, there was a big riff with Google Duplex last year or the year before, where they were calling on the phone and making appointments for people, and they couldn't tell that it was a computer. And so they agreed to actually say, this is an automated call, because they were so good at reproducing the voice, right? And then in China, we have AI newscasters who are able to read the news in such a way now that they actually look very human. So there's aspects of it, but if you really were to interact with any AI today, any chatbot, like there was one recently, I think it was called Mina from Google, that was supposed to be really great and you couldn't tell the difference.
Oh,
but you can tell after a while, it still gets caught in loops. So we're not quite there yet, but you know, most people think we'll be there in another 10 to 20 years.
All right, more about AI and QI and religious traditions that lend themselves to the idea that we're in a simulation hypothesis, which is basically like the Matrix world. The Simulation Hypothesis is the title of Rizwan Virk's book. We will come and get our minds blown a little more again with your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 10. So since this is a simulation hypothesis, have you devised ways to test the hypothesis, Rizwan?
Well, it's still a hypothesis, but there are a number of people who are looking at, can we find evidence of this? There was a group of physicists that found, for example, this lattice-like structure that showed there was a geometry that looked very much like pixels on a screen, right? And so it turns out there actually is a minimum length that we can measure. It's called the Planck length. And below that, we can't measure it. So in a sense, it ends up being like the most discrete pixel in our physical world. Now, there was a NASA physicist named Tom Campbell, and he wrote a book called My Big Toe, My Big Theory of Everything, which has been talking about this idea for a while. And, they wrote a paper called, Can We Detect If We're in a Video Game? And they came up with a series of experiments which are kind of like Wheeler's delayed choice experiment. And the idea, I talked about the weirdness of particles and quantum superposition and Schrodinger's cat. It actually gets even weirder because, that suggests that physical reality doesn't exist until we look at it. But what Wheeler's delayed choice experiment suggests is that the past is not what we think it is. Right, and probably the best way to explain it is by analogy. If, let's say, there was light coming from a distant galaxy and it was coming towards the Earth, and suppose there was a black hole in the middle and the light has to go to the left or the right. So, a lot of this quantum stuff comes down to choices, right? And if the light goes to the left, let's suppose we detect it in telescope A, and if the right light goes to the right, we detect it in telescope B. Let's say we put the telescopes on either side of the Earth. Well, suppose that black hole was 1,000 light years away, not miles, but light years away. That means that the decision of whether the particle goes left or right would have had to have been made 1,000 years ago, right? Because that's how long it took the light to get from, the black hole to the telescopes on Earth. Well, what the delayed choice experiment is telling us again and again, and this is just another one of those mysteries we can't figure out, is that that choice is not made until we detect it. Right, until the telescope looks at the light. So that means not only are we not seeing whether the cat is alive or dead, but we're seeing something that happened 1,000 years ago, and the choice is not made until it's observed. And so these types of experiments are kind of confounding our understanding of both time and space, right? So time may not even be what we think it is. It could be information that's being placed. And so there's a series of experiments now being run to kind of show that you need to have a conscious observer, like in a video game, to make that delayed choice work. And so, those are ongoing as well. It's, of course, difficult to prove, but, I think that many of the things that we can't explain start to make much more sense. When we think about it from a simulation point of view.
We generally talked about the science fiction, the games thus far, haven't gone very far into the spiritual traditions, but you mentioned Plato and his belief that we're just, seeing shadows of the real world, but it goes much farther than that. I mean, the idea of quantum indeterminacy wouldn't surprise, it seems like, Buddhists or Hindus, for example.
I talked a little bit about, this... the idea of karma and reincarnation, and the Buddha said that know that all phenomena are like reflections appearing in a very clear mirror, devoid of inherent existence. Right now, what does that sound like? It sounds like phantoms or pixels that get lit up for a period of time, and that so they posited that all of reality was a game, a stage play, if you will. In the Hindu Vedas, they talk about the Leela, which is like the stage play. Or like Shakespeare said, you know, that all the world's a stage and we're merely players on it. That these games are set up for a purpose, but they appear real to us. Now, in the Tibetan Buddhist traditions, they have this idea of dream yoga. And, you know, dreams is an interesting area of exploration because something we all understand. Right? We all dream at night, whether we remember the dreams or not. Well, you know, about 1,000 years ago, there was this idea of dream yoga that was developed. It was one of the 6 yogas of Naropa, who was a Buddhist master. And in this yoga, you learn to wake up inside a dream. So you learn to realize that what you were seeing was not real, that it was a dream, and that there was this other part of you that was in bed that was asleep. And you had to link your consciousness with that. Now, today we call that lucid dreaming, and many people have had a random experience of that, and I've had that myself. But they use this training of the dreaming attention to then train you to have the same kind of wake-up experience when you're awake, to say that, okay, even when you're awake, this is really like a dream. And there is another part of you that's outside of this simulated reality or dream world, outside of the illusion, that you don't remember, just like you don't remember when you're in a dream. And, you know, my contention is that most of the world's religions were founded when somebody peeked outside of the simulation, right? And then they came back and they tried to explain what they saw, kind of like with Plato's cave. Or if you think of the story of the 3 blind men and the elephant, right? Mm-hmm. Each of them saw the elephant or felt it, but because they're blind, they didn't see the whole thing. They just, you know, one said it felt like a trunk of a tree, but that was the legs. One said it felt like a long snake. He was feeling like the snout of the elephant. And one said it was like a house because he was feeling the body of the elephant. They were all kind of sensing the same thing through a limited perceptual window, and then they were trying to describe it. And to me, pretty much all the religions are telling us that there is another world. There are other entities outside of that world, like angels, that are watching us, and that we have somebody keeping track of what's going on here. So I think this idea goes deep within philosophy, but also within the religious traditions as well.
Well, sure. I mean, if somebody's watching us, you're basically talking about the essence of God for a lot of people there. Let's take some phone calls. Jamie in Medford, you're up. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rizwan Virk, the author of The Simulation Hypothesis.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Well, a couple of few random thoughts and a question. I miss the old Ananova program, which, for people not aware, was a fake female news anchor that was speaking using only text as the source for the news, and it was charming, but it had its day. I also think it was a program I saw. It was might have been Radio Lab, in which they demonstrated there was no such thing as free will, because the action of the body happened before the brain responded. And anyway, that's my couple of comments. I have a question. Has the author investigated the indigenous Australians and their concept of dream time, and could you compare and contrast that?
All right, good question, Jamie. Thanks.
Yeah, sure. You know, I'm not familiar with that program, Ananova, but yeah, I think, you know, you're seeing more and more sophisticated avatars reading the news, and pretty soon, you know, there'll be more virtual characters. On YouTube, some of the most popular characters now are actually virtual characters who are putting out shows. You know, on the Aboriginal side, I mean, I haven't studied them too much, but I'm broadly familiar, you know, with this idea of the dream time, which they say is the actual real world and has been around for a long period of time. And, you know, within dreams, in many Native traditions, not just the Aborigines, but, you know, within the Native Americans here as well, there's this idea that things happen in the dream state first before they happen. The Maricopa Indians in Arizona, you know, said everything happens in the dream first. And so, you know, dreams are a very complicated topic, and pretty much it's one of those topics where, you know, most theories about dreams are actually true, including the idea that dreams are used for rehearsal. You know, Jung thought that as well. Freud thought there was some wish fulfillment going on, and sometimes that's true. There are people who have noted precognitive dreams, particularly when somebody close to you dies. you see them in the dream state, and that's happened to so many people, and there's so much evidence of that, that I think this idea of, you know, and also that sometimes dreams are just, regurgitations of what we saw during the day. In the Tibetan traditions, they call that karmic trace dreams versus clear dreams. And so, you know, dreaming also is kind of a garbage collection mechanism for our consciousness. In computer science, we use garbage collection to clean up the memory. So, you know, it becomes both a way to get in touch with the world outside the simulation. So, you know, if you were playing a game and you wanted to send a message to somebody that's not in, the message doesn't appear in the physical world, you would send them like an instant message, right? And they would see it in their computer, but they wouldn't see it in the rendered world. And so it's possible we're getting messages, you know, in our dreams from entities that are outside the dream state, or the physical universe, as I like to call it, the great simulation that we're all a part of.
About 4 minutes left. Let's see if we can squeeze in another call. This is Al in Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I remember I read a book by, you guys probably familiar with Rajneesh, who speaks of that at one point some aborigines along the coast, the first time a ship came with a mast, they didn't see it, except the shaman who did. So my question is it possible that our perception, overrides the behavior of light, where we can see things?
Our perception overrides our perception. Okay, thanks for that. Our perception overrides, yeah, okay. Thanks, Al, for that. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very possible, because each of us is viewing the world through a perceptual lens that is our mind. And
lest anybody
brain.
Doubt, I did meet a neuroscientist a few years ago who said, yeah, about 90% of what we think we see is just sort of coming out of our brains.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, if you think of each of our brains as being like a rendering engine or a laptop, right, it's very possible, and we do this in video games all the time, where suppose your character and my character are standing in a field, and I'm level 2 and you're level 30, and we decide to render for the level 30 character a ship, right, or a spaceship, or a UFO, right? And the level 2 character doesn't render that, and we call it conditional rendering, and it's controlled by information in the cloud that is sent out. And so it's very possible that you have two people standing in what they think is the same location, but seeing very different things, which gets back to this idea of, is there a shared rendered world or not? There was a physicist named Eugene Wigner who proposed an experiment in the 60s, and he said, well, what if I were to see a particular collapse of the probability wave, which is this idea of going from probable to a single reality, and before I wrote down what I saw those particles do, my friend looks at those same particles and he sees a different collapse of the probability wave. Like, is that possible? Now, this is a pretty kind of jarring experiment, and it couldn't be done back then, but they just did it in Birmingham in the UK, and they found that it is possible for a slightly different collapse of several entangled particles. Now, you know, there needs to be confirmation of that, there needs to be different versions of that, but if that's true, it's telling us that not only is the physical world not what we think it is, but we may not all be looking at the same physical world. Like, there may actually be slight differences to what each of us is experiencing. And then, of course, there's the psychological layer where, I mean, there have been many studies where certain people can't see certain colors or certain letters, right, are just blocked out. And that gets into the psychological layer. So that's like the programming above the physical world itself, which I think may be closer to what the caller was talking about.
Just about half a minute left, Rizwan. Do you consider if the simulation hypothesis is true, whether it is benign, more sinister like in The Matrix, or essentially neutral?
Well, there's two big versions of the simulation hypothesis, and we touched on this earlier, but we didn't go into detail on it, and I like to call them the NPC version, the non-player character version, and the RPG version. And better way to think of it is the RPG version is like The Matrix, where Neo and Morpheus, who is named after the Greek god of dreams, existed outside the Matrix, and they were playing characters or avatars. So that's the RPG version. In the NPC version, we all are on a computer, and we don't actually exist outside of that computer. So that might be closer to the holodeck or the Agent Smith version, right? And so, you know, people ask me, well, isn't it a depressing thought? Well, if it's the NPT version, perhaps that's, you know, there's not a lot of free will. But if it's the RPG version, then, you know, we're here playing a character to learn lessons, and I find that to be actually quite encouraging and gives us a different lens with which to look at the challenges that come up in our lives as quests and achievements for us to level up.
It's a book that will simultaneously blow your mind, but is also a fairly easy read. It's called The Simulation Hypothesis, an MIT computer scientist shows why AI, quantum physics, and Eastern mystics agree we are in a video game. Rizwan Virk, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, take care. That'll do it for today's exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.